Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about full compliance with the Constitution, and we've got a champion that needs your help, that would use every penny you've got that you can spend or give him, and his name's Jerry Wistrand, and he is running a state auditor's campaign for the state of Missouri. Now, believe it or not, folks, an auditor actually goes through what, you know, what contracts are legitimate or what have you. It is huge if you have an auditor that is going to stand up as a champion to the Constitution. Because many of the contracts the state is creating and exercising are not within the powers of the state. Do you understand what I'm saying? As I said yesterday, it's really important, or actually on Friday, as I stated before, it's very important to have champions for the Constitution and somebody that's standing up and saying, hold me accountable. As a matter of fact, in our last show on Friday, we made a big point of talking about accountability because in the state of Washington, they have a perfect storm because they have a party chair who is a politician and political leader, party leader, in the state legislature. And, I mean, you know, when you have those two worlds combined, it never bodes well. And I'm just absolutely amazed that the Republicans in Washington State allow this to continue. This is the second time he's been elected, which means that there are real problems within the state party leadership, which means that, folks, we got to take these parties back. We got to quit giving them blind trust. They're not serving us. We've got to go in and we've got to convert the party into the party of, instead of big government Republicans, the party of constitutional compliance and holding our public servants accountable. It's all about accountability. Anyway, welcome back, Sean. And so I know he's there. So we're going to get back to the Massachusetts ratification debates. And I know that the last time or the last thing we kind of covered, I believe, what was it, slavery or, no, it was corporations. And so the next thing we're going to be covering today will be Monday, January 21st, out of the Massachusetts debates. And the little tag, or I should say, in the navigation pane, the issue or the matter, the highlight, or the headline is the use of corporations. Now, we're going to go ahead and dive into this because this is Rufus King. And so let's go ahead and dive into what Rufus King wanted to expound upon regarding the use of corporations.
The Honorable Mr. King rose to pursue the inquiry why the place and manner of holding elections were omitted in the section under debate. It was to be observed, he said, that in the Constitution of Massachusetts and other states, the manner and place of elections were provided for. The manner was by ballot and the places, towns. For, said he, we happened to settle originally in townships, but it was different in the southern states. He would mention an instance, in Virginia, there are but 15 or 20 towns and 70 or 80 counties. Therefore, no rule could be adopted to apply to the whole. If it was practicable, he said, it would be necessary to have a district the fixed place, but this is liable to exceptions, as a district that may now be fully settled may in time be scarcely inhabited. In the backcountry, now scarcely inhabited may be fully settled. Suppose a state thrown into eight districts and a member apportioned to each. If the numbers increase, the representatives in districts will be increased. The matter, therefore, must be left subject to the regulation of the state legislature or the general government. Suppose the state legislature, the circumstances will be the same. It is truly said that our representatives are but a part of the union, that they may be subject to the control of the rest, but our representatives make a ninth part of the whole. And if any authority is vested in Congress, it must be in our favor, but to the subject. In Connecticut, they do not choose by numbers, but by corporations. Hartford, one of their largest towns, sends no more delegates than one of their smallest corporations, each town sending two, except laterally when a town was divided. The same rule is about to be adopted in Rhode Island. The inequality of such representation, where every corporation would have an equal right to send an equal number of representatives, was apparent. In the southern states, the inequality is greater. By the Constitution of South Carolina, the city of Charleston has a right to send 30 representatives to the General Assembly, the whole number of which amounts to 200. The back parts of Carolina have increased greatly since the adoption of their Constitution and have frequently attempted an alteration of this unequal mode of representation. But the members from Charleston, having the balance so much in their favor, will not consent to an alteration. And we see that the delegates from Carolina in Congress have always been chosen by the delegates of that city. The representatives, therefore, from that state will not be chosen by the people, but will be the representatives of a faction of that state. If the general government cannot control in this case, how are the people secure? The idea of the honorable gentleman from Douglas, said he, transcends my understanding, for the power of control given by this section extends to the manner of election, not the qualifications of the electors. The qualifications are age and residence, and none can be preferable.
Okay, so anything you want to add to this?
Yeah, it goes right to what we're dealing with in Virginia, or were not long ago, with the gerrymandering of the districts, where they were trying to make all the districts controlled by Fairfax in the area in North Virginia. They had districts reaching from that urban center that's all Democratic, reaching out into the rural areas,
right,
so they could just completely disenfranchise those people.
Right. Okay, so let's look at the model, because what he's complaining about, and the real reason this is important, isn't because of the U.S. Constitution. It's because the way the states were configured. Now, I say this a lot, but I don't say it all the time, but you've probably heard me say that the U.S. Constitution is the exemplar. It is the perfect model of creating a government that will guarantee you checks and balances within your government. Now, when they created this federal constitution, it had and could not, and I emphasize this because I actually was in a presentation last week with a bunch of county commissioners that were all from different parts of the state, and I actually got pushback from a county commissioner. I won't mention his name, but I got pushback to say, hey, well, you know, what you're saying, you know, the counties aren't, you know, we're not the parties of the compact. You know, this state government is, you know, got all these powers and so forth. And yeah, I mean, this guy is like waving a white flag and saying, you know, you're running us over is welcome here. You know, just bring it on. Like, what? So let me take a quick pause. The Declaration of Independence is very, very clear. It creates the axiom that we, the people, create our government, that governments are instituted by we, the people, at the consent of the governed. I'm just paraphrasing here. And that we have this inalienable right that when our government is not doing what it should be doing, We have a right to alter, abolish, and or institute a new. This right here, what I just told you about these counties, only gives you proof, and it's an indictment of the necessity of we the people creating our county governments by creating county constitutions. We have this right. We have the right of claiming our county government. They're representing us. They're supposed to. And it doesn't matter what that state says. If the state says you can't do it, watch us. Just watch us. We're going to do it, and we're going to create this constitution. And this constitution won't be implemented until we have enough counties within the state that have implemented their own constitutions, have created and ready to implement. Once we get two-thirds, whatever this critical number, this magical number of the state, then we as the counties will then go and alter our state constitution because we're the parties to the compact. Now, this person challenged me and said, no, we're not. And I said, actually, if one examines the Enabling Act that Congress created, this state was created by delegates from the county, meaning that the counties were the parties to that compact. That when we look at this design that was created of these multiple republics, the federal republic, the state republic, and the county republic, we go through this time and time again, that you have a right. If that government that was created by your counties is no longer serving your happiness, you have a right to alter it and then institute anew. And it's time we do, folks. And the only way to get there is we have to create county constitutions. Do you understand what I just said? You have to start pushing constitutional compliance committees in your county so that people start understanding what a constitution is. A constitution is literally just a delegation of power. It is like a little power of attorney that delegates the specific powers you want that government to do. Now, when we look at the magnitude of what government does today, I believe you're going to want your county government in charge or at least driving the train on what your infrastructure should be, how commerce should be regulated in your state, your environment. I mean, nobody wants a dirty and unhealthy environment. Nobody wants, you know, our circumstances to kill us because, you know, profit over life. No. And we reasonable people equally agree. Everybody loves their family. They want to protect their family. Unfortunately, there's people that live thousands of miles away from us that are making decisions because they don't care about our life, our circumstances, and so forth, which is why they've been able to get away with doing things that have been destructive, that have been killing us, you know, whether it's polluting our environment or what have you. If we didn't have this national regulations and international regulations of corporations, which is all unconstitutional, it goes all the way back to the 1800s, and states were literally in control of corporations today, we would not have as many problems with pollution and those types of things because we'd be keeping our own backyard clean a little bit better than the nationalists, a little bit better than the internationalists, if you know what I mean. And if we actually move that responsibility down to the counties to ensure that the counties had say in that, then we'd be keeping our own backyards very clean. Does that make sense, Sean?
Absolutely. So, and you see people doing that all the time now. It's just that it's such a act of Congress is the term you want to use, but it's just frustrating, and it's a whole bunch of red tape and bureaucratic mess to try to get anything done. And the process that you're talking about is what we need to do in order to stop all that ridiculous foolishness.
And to unravel these centralized controls. We're not to have centralized controls. As a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson, the way he described political power when he started fathoming and operating within this new construct of government, that was completely foreign to him when he came here, came back from his emissary work in France and England. When he came back, he was just, it took him a while to absorb and understand how things were to operate. And as he looked, he basically kind of summarized that political power, based on the design of the Constitution, was centripetal, or actually centrifugal. When you look at the two forces, you have centripetal, which is pulling the energy inward. A good example in science of a centripetal force is the force of an atom, where all of these things evolving around the nucleus pull that atom and hold that thing together very tightly. So this force is pulling things in, kind of like gravity. Centripetal is where in nature, where you spin around and you, if you're holding a bucket of water, if you hold that bucket of water level, the rim of that bucket of water level to the, your rotation, the water will come out of the bucket. But if you spin and you allow that lip to basically become perpendicular to the deck or, you know, outward, flowing outward, It will contain all the water and hold all that water. That's centrifugal force. And I believe most people understand this. But just in case they don't understand the difference between centripetal and centrifugal, because they sound the same. Now, when Jefferson was explaining political energy, he said that the design of this republic was centrifugal. It was distributive. It was to allow the energy to flow outward closest to the people, where the people would be able to have governments locally to make their decisions. Now, at the very beginning, that was kind of at the state level because you didn't have government in your every day-to-day lives way out in the counties in Pumpkinville, what have you, when you get really out there. But today, it's the opposite. We have a centripetal political energy because the federal government and the global government wants to pull control, and they want to control everything from where they are. This is how backwards we are. This is how we. This is why things are going awry, because we're not operating by design. And this is, folks, the only way we're going to get there is we actually have to claim that government, our local government. I can't say it any plainer. Until you claim your county and start laying it out, you may have to have a couple constitutional conventions. That's okay. You know, you're not committed until you finally get to that state, because there's going to be points in time where you're not going to have James Madison. You're not going to have, you know, these really brilliant people, but we're trying to create a template for you. Your Constitution should be modeled after the U.S. Constitution. And I say this because in, you know, every state constitution I see, they list the glorious Bill of Rights first. Who cares? Right now, no state, no county can make or pass any law that infringes the privileges and immunities guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. It doesn't matter what your Bill of Rights say. What matters, and this is where we have to get back to, what powers are delegated. Does it really matter whether you have parental rights if you don't delegate to government their ability to be involved in your family or parents or your children or anything like that? Then why do you have to have a list of rights? The framers laughed. As we go through these things, we'll find how they actually mocked the anti-federalists for saying, we got to have a Bill of Rights. Because Iredell, Madison, all of these men were saying, I challenge you to list every right that you can think of under the sun that we need to protect, because you can't. Because within 100 years, new rights will be discovered that we will want to protect. They're all inalienable. What's important is we live and maintain government within the bounds we've empowered them. If they don't have the power to get involved in religion because it's not delegated to them, then slap their hands when they try to step into religion. Sorry, you can't go there. And if you let that happen at the county level, then that's fine. If you let that happen at the state level, that's fine. But woe unto us allowing that to happen at the federal level. And I think that at the state level, woe unto you as well. I believe that the real petri dish of governing and allowing, you know, these types of plays of whether you want to make abortion illegal, you can do that at the county level if you want. You don't have to allow abortion in your county. Imagine, folks, if you really look at the power that you can take back, because it's not about population. It's about the sovereigns within the state. There are two sets of sovereigns, right? In our government, we recognize and represent two sets of sovereigns. Sean, you ready to, you want to fill that, who the sovereigns are?
I would say the states are sovereign and the people are sovereign.
Yes. In other words, the government that we formed for the federal government, when we formed that federal government, the government we formed to do that was the state government and we the people, which is why at the state level, we should have we the people represented. And at the state level, we should have another sovereign that we created, we should have created for representation for that state government. And that would be the county government. When we the people create a government, we delegate power to it and grant sovereignty over those few powers. So this is why we actually have bicameral legislative bodies. And this is why, you know, we actually have these separations of powers to make sure that the Senate is guarding and taking care of those things that we want that county to be able to do for us, and that we can take care of ourselves, you know, in our own House of Representatives and be a check and balance on each other. This is why I say that U.S. Constitution is the exemplar. If we frame it and we go down the path of following the U.S. Constitution, then we will actually make sure that at the state level, the state will never trample on our county. That at the federal level, the federal government will never trample on our state. I mean, look at they went through these measures, but because we started caring more about our Bill of Rights, they started assuming more and more power. And hey, they've been spending us into they've been trying to spend us into oblivion, but it's all been fraud. And understanding this and taking back and creating a responsible government and one that isn't spending like a spendthrift, then there we go. What we're looking at here, and the reason why this is important, because you've heard me say through this past year since we started how important it is to understand that the states were literally different. I mean, they were governing themselves in so many different ways that corporations was a part of this. Now you see this, right?
Absolutely.
Now we see that when we look at the state legislature, because we haven't really covered that, but I've actually got a map of it. Some states were unicameral. Some states were bicameral. Some states had independent. There were three states that had independent courts. The rest of them were basically subjugated, or I should say courts that were subordinate to the state legislature. In other words, your state legislature was the end-all of government. It was the mighty poobah of your state. That 9 times out of 10, your governor was just basically more of an administrative head. I think there's only one or two states that actually had an independent executive. New York was one of them. I think Virginia was another. When you get more and more power and money, then that's when all of a sudden you start aggrandizing those types of positions. The irony is just when you start learning and you start seeing these things, you go, wow, I mean, that makes sense. That, you know, the corruption of money, we want to get these executives in here to start trying to, you know, take them sideways or at least protect our interests. Interesting. How the checks and balances, if we're following it, the executive can't do that. If we're following it, the Senate can't do that. If we're following it, the court can't do that. They all have their lanes in the road that they have to function within. And that's why the U.S. Constitution is the exemplar. And if we start creating that, then at the state level, your county would be represented in the Senate, period. Every county would have equal representation, just like the U.S. Constitution. And every state or every county would have an apportionment, or at least a guarantee of one representative, and or an apportionment if there's based on population, because that's where the most populated counties will get better representation in the House. But you'll always have the parity, or I should say the equality, down in the state Senate, where the, you know, your red counties would still be able to control those couple of really blue, highly populated counties. That right there, we'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I have to admit, I got a little chuckle out of myself because I was just so, I was just so absorbed in this clarity and helping this, helping you understand and laying this out. That folks, look at your state today. You may be living in the darkest of blue states, and yet you still have more red counties than you have blue. How is it that you wouldn't have parity, or at least a balance, by using the U.S. Constitution? It is the progressives, it's the Democrats, it's the leftists that want everything to be based on apportionment population, that your Senate and your House of Representatives get more in that paradigm, under the current paradigm, when the court basically unconstitutionally reconfigured us. We now have, you know, in California, there are now nine counties that are fighting for one representative in the House and the same in the Senate. And in Washington State, we have four or five counties fighting for one representative or two representatives in the House between all of them and one senator. When you do that, then the population center takes full control over both sides. And it completely ignores this government that you instituted to govern you. Where does the court get off to say you can't have that government? It's not in the Constitution. We already know they don't have the ability to create law, and they're doing all sorts of things like this. Let me just take a quick second. I've got to thank all of my loyal listeners and that have been listening and paying attention. Thank you. God bless you. I need you to help become the statesman in getting this information so that people start to understand how critical this is. It's a game changer. I'm telling you, when people actually start realizing and learning the beauty of this system we've been gifted by the divine hand of providence, oh my gosh. Where would we be if everybody was promoting this show? It's, you know, there's no money in this. If everybody was promoting this show to learn for themselves, I mean, you're not paying a penny for this. God bless Red State Talk Radio for airing this as long as they have. I'm here by the grace of God to serve and do everything I possibly can. And what more can I do? I mean, Sean, any suggestions?
You can run for president.
No, I'm just kidding. You know what? But thank God for you. I mean, I don't do it enough. You know, when you come in and you challenge and you find these things, you say, hey, what about this? I mean, God bless you for those things, because I skim over. There's just so much I can easily skim over that we can't cover it all unless it's been brought up, and that you provide that. And that's big. because I think that that really helps people start to see, you know, you may find things that might challenge or question, but when you back out and you look at the macro, you go, oh, well, hold on here. That's those things, you know, so many times we fall our people fall into the, oh, well, the court ruled. And that is a huge misnomer. Never utter the words, well, the court ruled this. Because almost 9 times out of 10, the court made a ruling over something they had no jurisdiction to even rule on. And they have no ability to define or redefine anything that is not constitutionally granted to them. We've elevated the court. They've elevated themselves to rule us, which is why we're in this quagmire. They're a big agitator in this pool, if you understand what I'm saying. So back to what we're covering, because I don't want to just belabor this point, because there's all these rat holes that go down. We're now looking at where Mr. King has helped everybody kind of understand how corporations are being formed within counties and so forth that are seizing or taking control. Now, whatever the interests are, whether these are local corporations, what have you, governing corporations, doesn't matter. This is a way of how they're changing the landscape. And if you actually use the U.S. Constitution of obtaining representation, and you use the U.S. Constitution at the county level, then corporations go, they disappear. Any corporations you're using goes away, because the right of the people's suffrage in the county cannot be questioned, and the right of the people's suffrage at the state level cannot be questioned, and the right of the sovereign government, your county in the state, cannot be questioned. When we use that form of a constitution, then we are securing our suffrage. But these corporations create advantages. They create factions and so forth. And this only goes to show you the level of complexity and the problems that they were having. Most of these things kind of went away. I don't think these corporations exist at all anymore. As the states kind of abandoned and started basically integrating this constitutional structure in most of these original states where they shifted to bicameral and so forth, and it took a while. I mean, when you look at the Electoral College, it took until the 1830s before the people were actually able to choose their electors across all states, except for one. South Carolina refused to ever let the people choose their electors. Even though that's how, when we cover it in these ratification debates, we're going to actually find they're going to say that the electors are to be chosen by the people. That's why the electors are in the representative section of Article 1. They're not a separate section. Somebody gets to choose them, or that the state legislature gets to choose them. No, they're right there with the representatives of the House, where the people get to choose them as well. Anyway. So let's go ahead and move on, because this really helps complicate if you're really trying to figure out how in the heck were things working back then, because all the states were working differently. Their common law was implemented differently. I mean, they were going in all these different directions. So this kind of helps you understand even a greater view of, when we look at the macro, how crazy these states were functioning and operating and coming together under the U.S. Constitution. Now, this next part that we're going to cover, which is literally the next part, and as a matter of fact, I'll read the lead into this, because what comes right after what you read, Sean, is on motion, resolved as follows, viz. Whereas there is a publication in the Boston Gazette and the Country Journal of this day as follows, viz. And this was read. Now, this is happening in the Massachusetts ratification debates. And so this is important, because I want to show you how rumors and or how duplicit people use different tactics to instill fear and to try to do things that try to influence outcomes. Now, we're a few days into this ratification debate, and all of a sudden, the Boston Gazette, or whatever it was I just read, the Boston Gazette and the Country Journal basically published this. Now, go ahead and read this regarding bribery and corruption.
Quote, bribery and corruption. The most diabolical plan is on foot to corrupt the members of the convention who oppose the adoption of the new Constitution. Large sums of money have been brought from a neighboring state for that purpose, contributed by the wealthy. If so, is it not probable there may be collections for the same accursed purpose nearer home? Resolved, or that's from the Sentinel, resolved that this convention will take measures for inquiring into the subject of the said publication and for ascertaining the truth or falsehood of the suggestion therein contained. Ordered that the messenger be directed to request the printers of the said Gazette to appear before this convention forthwith to give information respecting the said publication. Afternoon, the messenger informed the convention that he had acquainted the printers of the Boston Gazette and Company of the order of the forenoon respecting them, and was answered that one of them would attend the convention this afternoon. A letter from Messrs. Benjamin Eads and Son, printers of the Boston Gazette, etc., and Company, relative to the publication entered this morning, read and committed to Mr. Parsons, Mr. Nassan, Mr. Gorham, Mr. Widgery, Mr. Porter, Mr. Gore, and Mr. Thomas of Plymouth.
Okay, so they don't get into some of the facts that they find, but this is very interesting because I want you to get your arms around this. First off, there is an allegation that there is a corruption afoot that wants to actually attack by using money and corruption those people who are against the ratification of the Constitution. Now, let me ask you something. Do you believe that there would be money to actually go and try to corrupt those who are against the Constitution? Do you believe that this allegation that large sums of money have been brought from a neighboring state for the purpose of the contributed by the wealthy so that they could actually get the ratification in Massachusetts? Do you believe that this is a true allegation? What are your feelings on this?
Well, I mean, I have no way of knowing whether it's true or not true. I mean, I think they did the right thing trying to find out if it was true, but then that comes upon freedom of the press. But at the same time, then it could be libel. But, I mean, the same thing was going on with the Federalist Papers, as we've gone through, that they were trying to coerce and influence people. I believe it's possible. Okay. Especially nowadays when you see what's going on, where we have these so-called philanthropist billionaires that are funding every kind of traitorous action in the country, and nothing ever happens to them.
Okay, so as I look at ideology, I believe that the ideology of those going into the convention for the Constitution, those ideologically against the Constitution, are pretty hard cast. I believe if anybody tried to corrupt either side, it would cause alarm within the ranks immediately. In other words, it wouldn't come from an external source that this is happening. It would come from within the ranks. Hey, I was just approached and offered a bribe, a certain amount of money, if I would vote to secure the Constitution. Does that make sense? And that would be the same way on both sides. If I think there were corrupt efforts, a truth would come from within the ranks, not externally.
I would say that that's kind of hard to judge from our distance.
Okay.
But considering that a lot of these people were holding human beings as property, I would say it's not impossible.
This is Massachusetts. This is Massachusetts.
Happened immediately after the Constitution, like with the cod fisheries bounty and other things like that. I would say there are some factions within there that might be, you know, susceptible to bribery and corruption.
No, but my point is, I think that if there was any legitimacy, it would have actually came from internally first, not externally. I think that they got so far through this that they wanted to throw a widget. But that's one of the reasons, I believe, why they never published the facts in this. They would have included it had there been any truth to it. I believe that they would have included it. But I believe it was just like, you know, it was a red herring. But that being said, here's the interesting thing. They actually had the power and authority as a convention to basically, like a grand jury, to subpoena, to call these men forth. Do you will appear? Do you see this? I mean, sir, if you look today, and if we had a convention that was going like this, I don't think anybody in that convention would have thought that they would have had the authority, like a grand jury, to summons, you know, members of the press or these people to come forward and testify, to give evidence or to testify to, you know, facts or what have you. If you understand what I'm saying, they were formed under the sanctions of the state and empowered to do something, and they basically took that authority and they literally ran with it and used it, like I said, as in the form of a grand jury, because you can see exactly what they did. They resolved and ordered. Interesting. Today, I don't think people understand that when it comes to our government, these types of things are a part of that. The authority that you hold when you're a part of this type of a delegation and so forth. Now, I don't know what really happened. I just look at this as a typical external, you know, rumor, what have you. But even though it was external, it was ran in the Gazette. And the reality is they didn't include it in this. That's the real question, why? Because it should have actually, if there was any substantial, you know, okay, why did you run that? Or why didn't you run that? Or what have you? Anyway,
I got the same question, and it's just like what they do today, sure, where they hold these congressional hearings on everything you could imagine.
Yes.
Like weaponization of government, or, you know, this happened and that happened, and James Comer talking about he's got a whole room full of evidence that the Bidens were being, you know, doing pay for play, and he's got the account numbers and the shell companies, and then a week later, poof, it's gone like it never happened. So, and judging from what I've learned, and there was a time, just being honest, there was a time when I thought that all of these men were above reproach.
Uh-huh.
But then the more you learn about, yep, like Hamilton's mm-hmm. lifestyle and his goings on at the time, yeah, he's nothing like what's been portrayed in the history books.
Right. Well, and in Massachusetts, these were the Puritans. And don't forget that the Puritans suffered through both, you know, the initial onslaught from Britain, and they also suffered from the Shay Rebellion, because they were that, I don't want to say that dirt poor, but they were struggling. They were struggling. And so keeping that in mind, keeping this, you know, this state of Massachusetts, what they were going through, and because we'll get into some of the anti-federalist comments a little bit further down. But I wanted to highlight this because this is the only convention where there was an article that was ran that caught the attention, and boom, next thing you know, they stopped everything and said, we want to get to the bottom of this, and they went out to do that. And so, interesting. It's a part of history. It would be great to include the facts. I just never have the time because I'm always searching for lots of other things that are probably far more important. But understanding these things, if you know, hint, hint, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, if you want to go look for that, I'd include it. But let's go down to the note a little bit later on that day where Mr. King kind of makes this note or this comment. Go ahead. It's in blue.
We now come, sir, to the consideration of the powers with which that government shall be clothed. The introduction to this Constitution is in these words, quote, we the people, etc. The language of the Confederation is we the states, etc. The latter is a mere federal government of states. Those, therefore, that assemble under it have no power to make laws to apply to the individuals of the states confederated. And the attempts to make laws for collective societies necessarily leave a discretion to comply with them or not. In no instance has there been so frequent deviation from first principles as in the neglect or refusal to comply with the requisitions of general government for the collection of monies.
Okay, so the point that I think he makes in this short paragraph, or this portion of it, is that when you look at the Confederation didn't grant, they could have granted powers to the Continental Congress to basically use force because they tried to amend it. They tried to amend the Articles of Confederation to grant them the powers. The only difference between the Articles of Confederation and this new Constitution is that there were a few powers granted where the federal government could actually create laws that would affect the states. One of those laws would be the apportionment and taxation, that they could go and enforce that. And other laws that they could enforce, i.e., a uniform rule of bankruptcies, a uniform rule of naturalization, copyright regulations and laws. Very few, when you really look at those very few laws, that's why Article 1, Section 8 is the legislative authority of the federal government. Nowhere else, if it's anywhere else, except for maybe the amendments, but in the rest of the body of the Constitution, they can't make laws regarding any of that part. Any Article 1, Article 2, other than Article 1, Section 8. Article 1, Section 1 through 7 and Article 1, 9 and 10, Sections 9 and 10, they can't make laws regarding those things. They can't make laws regarding Article 2, Article 3, 4, 5, 6, and so forth. So the point is that he's really clarifying that this government is going to have very limited powers, unlike the other government that could not make any law. It was like they were lipstick on a pig. And this is a government, this Articles of Confederation, this lipstick on a pig, is what some people were saying, that was the epitome, the best government of them all. I have to laugh. How? I mean, these brilliant men realized the impotency and the ineptness of the Articles of Confederation, and it didn't take them long to say, we've got to come up with something else, which is what they did. So the next one, which is the next line right underneath it, money and debt, is the next one we want to dive into. And this is where they actually start getting into some of the dollars and so forth. Let's go ahead.
All righty, sir. This fact is true. The history of our own country is a melancholy proof of a similar truth. Massachusetts has paid while other states have been delinquent. How was the war carried on with the paper money? Requisitions on the state for that money were made. Who paid them? Massachusetts and a few others. A requisition of $29 million were quoted on Massachusetts, and it was paid. The state has paid in her proportion of the old money. How comes it, then, that gentlemen have any of this money by them? Because the other states have shamefully neglected to pay their quotas. Do you ask for redress? You are scoffed at. The next requisition was for $11 million, $6 million of which were to be paid in facilities. the rest in silver money, for discharging the interest of the national debt. If the legislatures found a difficulty in paying the hard money, why did they not pay the paper? But $1.2 million have been paid, and six states have not paid a farthing of it.
Okay, so let's stop right there because we just got a couple minutes left, and I don't want to gloss over this. So Massachusetts was going through this hardship, and so when the Continental Congress needed more money, and it's not like Continental Congress is only going, you know, okay, well, these other states, so let's up the apportionment so that we can, you know, get more out of the states that are paying. They didn't play that game. But these other states were deliberately ignoring, not paying their debt and so forth. And so they're creating this, I think, a good picture that kind of helps everybody see how Massachusetts, by, you know, the Puritans, were going through this hardship, but they were trying to do things right. Now, here's the question. When we look at the Constitution and what it was going to do, it was going to guarantee that this would never happen again. And down the road, we're actually going to find people that say, we can do without this government. Let's let everybody else join. We'll stay out of it. Why? Because now you actually have a government that's going to make sure everybody carries their bit. Everybody carries their load. I'm just amazed how there were anti-federalists in Massachusetts that, you know, made these complaints, and yet they didn't want to partake of this government that was actually rectifying or redressing these complaints. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. And another point is, and people, I've heard people recently talk about this when they're trying to talk about these different, I would call them conspiratorial processes and methods, talking about the Articles of Confederation was never gotten rid of, that the Constitution was, like you talk about, a runaway convention, which is ridiculous. All you have to do is go into the journals of Congress, and they were telling the people in the states, if we don't do something, the government is going to dissolve and the union will dissolve because we have no money and no way of paying the debts for the country.
Right. Well, the true answer for the Article of Confederation proponents, their poor argument is they only need to read these ratification debates, because in the ratification debates, the state legislatures and or these conventions literally tell Continental Congress they are adopting this new constitution and checking out of Continental Congress and the Articles of Confederation. So they don't, I mean, the fact that they're trying to utter things that, you know, it's like Swiss cheese trying to hold water. Their arguments do not support what they're trying to say. The documents right here in the ratification debates clearly lay out that every single one of these states deliberately left the Articles of Confederation to become a part of this new union and accepting the Constitution. This is the biggest lie. You know, these people that purport this fact of the AOC is still in play. It's out. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process,
process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.